All right, Mid-Year. Today is Tuesday, June 26th, 2013. It's about 10:10 in the morning. I'm Judy Silva. I'm here at Bailey Library, Slippery Rock University of Pennsylvania with Dr. Bill Williams. This is an oral history interview for Rock Voices. Morning, Bill.
Good morning, Judy. It's so nice to see you today.
Thank you. I'll be asking you some questions about yourself and your time at Slippery Rock University.
Good.
Okay. Can we start with some biographical information?
Sure.
Your full name and date of birth.
William Frederick Williams. I was born May 4th, 1945.
Okay.
5445.
Catchy.
Yeah, catchy too. Yes.
And where were you from?
In Mercer County Hospital in Mercer, Pennsylvania.
Huh. I thought I read in here you were from Greenville.
Yeah, yes.
I was thinking Greensburg, right? Okay.
Greenville, yes. Okay. I grew up on a farm outside Greenville, Pennsylvania, three miles south of town. Hmm. Went to Greenville High School. Graduated in 1963. Played football, wrestled.
Did you?
Yeah. Hmm. Had a scholarship to Teal College for sports for a year and decided I didn't like that.
And for sports and for football?
Well, football and wrestling.
For yes. Both, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And then I went to Youngstown where I didn't have to do sports and could have fun.
Mm. It was the 60s.
City. Your 60s. It was a city, yes, exactly.
That too, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I think I started at Youngstown in 65 and stayed there until I got my master's degree. I got my master's degree in 70. Got a BA and then an MA in English.
In English, yeah. Literature?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Then I went to Kent for several years and decided, I was in their PhD in English program. And it was bizarre. It was, I started at Kent in 1970. And May 4th of 1970, my 25th birthday,
Yeah. They
celebrated by shooting four students, right?
Nice.
Which was kind of exciting. Huh?
You were there.
I went up, I had applied for an assistantship at Kent to do graduate work. And I had a friend that lived in Kent. So the night before May 3rd, I went up to, I was going, on May 4th, I was going to go in and see what the status of everything was and meet some people.
Yikes.
And on the night of May 3rd is when they brought the tanks in. So I laughed.
Yeah.
I thought, tanks are coming to town. It's, you know, it's 1970. This is not a sign of tranquility, right? So I just laughed. I was living in Youngstown at the time.
Peaceful Youngstown.
Yeah, it's peaceful Youngstown.
People got shot just walking in the street.
Right, yeah.
No tanks.
Yeah, no tanks. And at least in Youngstown, you knew why you were getting shot, okay? And you knew who was doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah. They only shot you if they had a reason. You may not have liked the reason, but they had one, so yeah. So Youngstown was much safer in terms of quirkiness at that moment in time, because the National Guard didn't apparently have a lot of reason. They were just out having
they stayed
a good
out
time.
Of Youngstown.
They were just out practicing
too
their marks with
them.
You.
So where'd you do your PhD then?
I spent 3 or 4 years at Kent, and then I did my doctorate at IUP eventually. I finished it there.
So you started it at Kent and finished it at
IUP, yeah. So that was good. It was good for me because I got what I got at Kent was a fairly new critical PhD program in literature, and I'd gone through all the coursework and I'd, couldn't decide why or what. And I didn't want to spend the rest of my life writing about the minutia of Wordsworth's life or something like that. And not that it wasn't totally fascinating.
I'm sure.
Probably his sister thought so anyway, you know. But I didn't want to do that. So I kind of took a break from it all. I taught at a community college in West Virginia for 3 years. And I think it was the end of my second year or third year when I was there. A woman that was there also in English, two of us were the whole English department, I had seniority though. So, you know, they have this program at IUP where you can do coursework in the summer. So if you're teaching, you could still finish that out. And it, you know, it's way more interesting because they have these other options rather than just the minutiae of Wordsworth life, yes, between ages 12 and 14. It's hard to teach.
You got it, yeah.
Yeah, you got to get down in the weeds and right. You know, long ways, yeah. So they said, well, maybe I'll try it. So I checked into it and said, well, this looks like some fun. So I went up there and I did a summer. And then at the end of that summer, I started my first summer there. I started here. I decided, my wife at the time was working here. Barbara Williams was her name at the time. And so I was commuting from Newcastle to West Virginia Northern Community College, you know, 5 days a week. Yeah. Well, 4 days a week, the fifth day.
West Virginia Northern?
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, which is...
I've never heard of it. I went to West Virginia West then.
Yeah. West Virginia Northern has a branch in Weirton, West Virginia. The main campus is in Wheeling, and it has another branch in New Martinsville.
Okay, so that part of West Virginia, the Panhandle.
Yeah, Panhandle, yeah. And then once a month I went to Charleston to be on the, I was there, the campus, I was the college state rep. It was, you know, like they have legislative and assembly and stuff here, they had something like that there.
Huh. So, I was, so you got into that early.
I did. I don't know how that happened.
Huh.
They liked me, so they elected, or they didn't like me. I was never sure which way that went. So anyway, I thought, well, that's just crazy. I'm not going to continue that commute for the rest of my life. And so there was a temporary opening here, so I took it and taught. I started fall of 1981 here as a part-time temporary faculty member in the English department. And then they did a search that year for a tenure-track position in English, and I was hired for that. So. Mm. The following fall, I started as a tenure track.
Who was here then? Who were your colleagues in English?
Well, everybody that was still alive.
Dee Dee.
Carrie Toman, Kay Quick.
Know these names?
Yeah, see, I knew that. The Currys.
Yeah.
The English department had already established itself as a couples department.
Uh-huh.
There was Steve and Elizabeth Curry, mm-hmm. Joe and Joe Nagan, Tom and Sue Mullen, Mike and Penny Kelly.
Huh. Wow.
Yeah, exactly. See, and then it was Bill and Barbara Williams. Yeah, of course. Yeah, exactly. So
we had all these.
Yeah, if you weren't married to somebody in the department, you didn't count. Right? So it was. We were the last couple that were hired into the English department.
Huh.
She was hired 3 years before me, and at the time as a temp, and she taught 3 years as a temp. Her third year as a temp was my first year on a tenure track, and they'd converted hers to a tenure track. But when she was hired, you only needed 3 years to get tenure. So my first year on a tenure track, they'd already changed it, so you needed five. She got grandparented, grandfathered in, I guess. I guess maybe that would be grandmothered, I'm not sure.
I think that term is politically correct, grandfathered.
Yeah, we're not sure, but we'll try it. Yeah, we'll run with it. Which was the quirky part, because then we also, our first years on a tenure track position, she got her temps to count toward years to count toward her tenure. And so her third year, tenure track was it, third 3 years, and she could apply for tenure. And that was my first year. But that was her first tenure track year.
Uh-huh.
So the computer would generate who had seniority randomly. And so according to the computer, I had more seniority than she did. And I didn't get tenure until 5 years after she did. But I had seniority because of the... Which was a quirky thing.
Did that cause a rift in your marriage at the beginning of the...
No, we had other rifts. Yeah, we'll not go into
we
that
part. We don't
need
part, to. Right? No, no, we'll need to get that personal.
No.
So, at IUP, Shakespeare? You studied Shakespeare?
Well, I studied whatever I wanted at IUP. Yeah. I had, because I'd done the coursework at Kent for a doctorate, they had blocks you had to satisfy. Mm. But I satisfied all of them. So a lot of what I did, I had Shakespeare courses at IUP. I always had Shakespeare courses. I liked Shakespeare. But I did a lot of literary criticism. I did some stuff in social linguistics and psycholinguistics and composition theory. So I had the opportunity to look at doctoral work in English studies in a more generalized way because of that. And they had created their program not to be a new critical approach to doctoral work in English. So they had more slightly updated versions of literary criticism and less of that, what was basically the 60s doctoral school stuff going. So it was good. It was a good change.
Sounds like better preparation for teaching.
Yeah, it is. They're much better. Because they had already figured out that's what happened. When you got a doctorate in English, you actually taught.
Yeah.
Not everyone went out and published and just sat and...
Sat with their doctor name, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So,
well, good. Yeah. We benefited from that, I'd say. All right. And what was your first job?
My first job.
Yeah. You worked on the farm as a kid, right?
Yeah, I grew up on a farm. We worked on the farm. That's not a job.
No, what was your first?
That's just what you have to do.
Right.
My first job as a kid was in a gas station in Greenville. Hmm. I was probably 12 or 13. Hmm. I pumped gas and washed cars. Hmm. It was okay. I made a little money. And then because of the farm life, which is really why I went into athletics, because if I played football and wrestled, that meant from August when school, even before school started, right, I got excused from farm duties, right? And I didn't have to go back to farm duties until after everything was, all the sports were done, which was in the spring. So that worked pretty well.
Why not baseball too, Bill?
I did track 1 year. The first year I said, okay, I'll do track too, and that'll just take me right through the end of the year.
Who picked up the slack at home?
Well, they figured out how to do that, right? So then I didn't have to. So that's kind of why I got into athletics anyway. Mm. But it was okay. It was good for me.
Yeah. I'm
strong. And I'm very physically impatient. I want to be in motion, I want to do things, be active. So school's not very good for that.
Yeah.
But athletics is. So it gave me a place out, and then I got a scholarship to Teal, which was fine, except I was like, whoa, sports and academics. And the kids, I was good in football in high school, but I was the same size I am now.
And so what did you play?
When I went to college, I was a lineman, believe it or not. Yeah, I was fast and strong. And when I went to college, I was fast and strong, and they were fast and strong and big. So that didn't work real well, but, you know, so I said, you know, this isn't going to really work for me. So I said, I'm going to get harmed out here if I keep this up. So I decided to go elsewhere, and it was expensive enough that it was way easier to go to Youngstown cost-wise than stay at Teal, so I just moved over to Youngstown, did my undergraduate work there, and then at the end of that I spent a year and got my master's and moved on. So when my dad was a foreman at the Greenville Steel Car Company, so when I was finished high school, I worked there in the summers because to earn money to pay for college and stuff.
Is that a union job?
Yeah, they have unions there. They were good. It was interesting. So,
did that get you interested in unions? Or?
Well, I, you know, you grow up in Western Pennsylvania, you know about unions.
Yeah.
I mean, it was important in this area because of what happened in the steel industry around, you know, strike busting and stuff in Pittsburgh, that whole deal. You know, probably been to the Frick Museum down there. Mm-hmm. Where he made sure they shot people.
What did your dad think, though?
Dad was pretty ambivalent about it. I mean, he worked at the steel car company. He was management.
Right, he was management.
So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. And he was okay with the unions. He sometimes wondered about their sanity. But, you know, they too, if they worked for... It was interesting because almost all the people, the guys up there that worked, had farms too.
Hmm.
You know, they kept rolling. So, you know, they didn't want to work 12 months a year, year in and year out at the steel car company. So
mm-hmm.
if they had a contract run out and they've got a strike, they didn't mind being on strike for 4 or 5 months. They caught up with their farm work.
Interesting.
Stuff like that.
Hmm.
Yeah. And even when the steel car was running well, it was still not a 12-month-a-year job for guys on the line. Because they'd run out of orders and then they'd be laid off for a while. So that, which is why everybody had a farm. You couldn't, the mill itself didn't create enough revenue for a 12-month existence.
Interesting.
So they had farms that kind of filled in behind it. Things were a lot, economically, a lot poorer than they are now in this area.
Mm-hmm.
And probably lots of other places too. You know. The 50s were not notoriously wealthy.
Right. Did your family have a car?
Yeah, we had a car. We lived out of town. We lived 3 miles out of town. So, yeah, we always had cars. And I know, I remember growing up until we had a coal furnace. And the coal furnace had a came with a unit that heated the water.
Hmm. I've never seen that.
In the winter.
Huh. Like so, next to it? Or?
Well, it was integrated. So the heat of the coal coming off would heat the water. So you'd have hot water, which was kind of an efficient use,
yeah.
Right? Except in the summer, when we didn't have hot water. You could have hot water,
sure.
But you had to figure out some way to make it that way because it wasn't there, right? So so we didn't have hot water probably in the summer until I was 10 or 12 years old. We have an acre of garden. We got to take care of. My mother made bread all the time until I was probably close to 12 before they started buying bread in a store.
Mm-hmm. So it was horrible white bread they started making.
Yeah, I thought it was wonderful.
Sliced. Yeah, sure you did.
It was mm-hmm. sliced. Man, mm-hmm. this isn't that stuff they make at home.
White and you could squeeze these, it in.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, make dough balls out of it.
Right. Not so good for you.
Yeah,
maybe contributed to your heart attack later on.
Well, you never know.
No,
yeah,
you never know.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was growing up, and I don't know, I like school too, so I did well in school.
Yeah, so, somebody said you were smart, Diana Dreher said
yeah,
you were
I
smart.
Yeah, I know, people claim.
All right, well let's jump forward to Slippery Rock.
Yes, sir,
yeah. You said you were hired here in 81?
Fall of 81, yeah.
Okay, and in the English department as...
part-time temp.
Right, okay. And eventually moved
next
up.
Next year so. I became tenure track.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Later became chair.
Then I started as an instructor, and 3 years later I was assistant professor, and then 3 after that I got promoted to associate, and 5 after that I got promoted to full, and in 95, I think, I became chair of the department. Spring of 90, I started in May of 95. And I did that until 03, same time I quit being president of the union.
Oh, you were both
at the same time for mm-hmm. almost 10 years, the two of me, 9 years. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't teach. I mean, that was full reassigned workbook because English is a big department.
Yeah.
So that's when I quit teaching.
Wow.
And, that was actually management then, although it was management in a union way, you know?
Huh. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, what's a union president? That job's not teaching. It's
right.
You're reassigned to do what's basically a managerial kind of job, and the same with chairperson. It's sort of a...
True,
it's the bottom level of management in the academic system.
Right. Yeah. But you kept your faculty status until...
Yeah, still faculty until 2003.
Until you crossed over.
Yeah. Until I did. I was even a faculty member after I crossed over for a while.
I wondered about that.
Because it was interim until for a couple of years before they did the search, and then they... Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then I became the real provost.
Right.
So, but during interim, I was still faculty, and if I had decided not to pursue the permanent position as provost, I would have gone back to my faculty job.
Mm-hmm.
But I said, well, I think I'll just do this one. It's more entertaining in some ways.
Yeah, right.
Well, I hadn't taught for 10, 12 years by then anyway, and I had no real urge to go back to the classroom to do that. I never minded. I enjoyed teaching. It was a good experience, but I moved on to something else, and it just seemed like the right thing to do. So, and if I hadn't been picked in that position, I'd have probably gone elsewhere.
Hmm.
So I had a lot of opportunities to do that. So, but I didn't really want to leave. But, you know, once you... I decided that position matched me in many ways.
Yeah.
So.
What ways? The provost position.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. It allowed me to interact with the university in the way I saw it was appropriate. I enjoyed working with faculty, so that gave me the opportunity to do that at a different level, to try to help shape the way the university was moving. It allowed me to take my vision of the academic world and kind of use that to mold how the programming and parts and pieces were playing out around here. Not, you know, no position gets to do anything he or she wants, but it had more influence.
More than even if you leapfrogged up to president, you would have had less hands-on for that kind of
exactly.
thing. So that's
that was
ideal
the
for you.
Yeah, it was the it's the perfect place if you really want to work in an academic milieu and have the maximum influence over the academic part. That's
right.
It. Yeah.
That's the big picture right there.
Yeah.
So do you want to talk about some of the things that you accomplished as provost or that happened while you were provost?
Good things. It was all good things.
Just the good things.
Yeah, that's all there was. It was all good. It was all roses, sunshine. Birds were tweeting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
from
you
your
know
point
how that
of view.
Went. Yeah, exactly.
I was here. Don't forget. So.
Yeah. But you had a very limited view. See, you only heard the whiners.
No, as far as everything was good. So
it was pretty good. Actually, it was. It was, you know, I think Bob Smith and I were a pretty good team because he learned after a little bit not to bother me, that I'd take care of it, that I really would take care of it. He didn't have to micromanage what I was doing, which he liked to do because he always was worried somebody else wasn't getting it right. and I learned to trust him to be there when I needed him.
So, but that had been his job, so I could see why he would have that tendency
He had that tendency even if it wasn't, okay? He just liked to be in control. I know. I remember a cabinet meeting one day. He says, well, why didn't you bring this here? And I said, well, I could have. I said, but you have a lot of stuff on your plate. And if I'm taking care of it and it's going to work the way you want to, I didn't see why I'd want to bother you with it.
Mm-hmm.
And he got it then.
Yeah.
He suddenly understood that I wasn't trying to subvert him or I wasn't trying to do things he didn't want done. I was trying to protect him from having to engage in things he didn't need to.
Right.
So once we got there, it was good. And we, you know, enrollments went up, right? Quality of students went up.
Yeah.
Accreditations were always... We got everything we tried to get accredited, we got accredited.
Good.
We got the best Middle States review ever
at
the university.
Yeah.
That was a pretty spectacular moment in time.
That's a big deal.
It is a big deal.
Yeah.
And I was here when it happened, and I was in a position of leadership when it happened. I didn't do it, though. I mean, what I did was look at the institution in a performance model rather than a historical model without losing sight of the importance of the historical part of an academic community. And that is clearly the whole point, as near as I can tell, of an academic institution is the preservation of knowledge, right? Okay. That's how you institutionalize it.
Yeah.
Right? So you can't pretend the history doesn't exist.
Right.
And it's amazingly important.
Yeah, I'm pretty big on the history.
Yeah, yeah. But the other half of that is it still has to be preserved in a way that's economically sustainable,
right,
or it won't be preserved anyway.
I mean,
if it goes down, it goes, psh, they close the doors, they burn the books, and everybody goes and plants corn or something. I don't know what they do then, right? But it's a very necessary component also. So I put those two pieces together, my deep respect for the history of the humanities and the academic traditions with the necessity of a functional business model. And I think that's what I brought to that position.
Wasn't that the first time in your career you had to focus in that way on the business model? I mean, in class, were you doing ABSCOF?
I worked on contract negotiations as ABSCOF president for almost 9 years, and you can't look at those from the position of leadership at a university without understanding that there's an economic cost that has to be taken care of, whether that's covered by an allocation from the state or tuition dollars from students, there's still a cost that has to be accounted for. And any raise in the faculty salary is going to be paid for somewhere.
Yeah.
And it's not that it's wrong, it's just that it's always in a few, probably if they had recorded those little blurbs at the assemblies. I used to say that to the faculty.
Hmm.
You know, we have, there's an economic necessity, here's where we are, this is the, here's the constraints. We're going to get as much as we can with the understanding that we can only get enough that it doesn't harm the institution.
Right.
Because the institution's viability is what makes all of our jobs possible. It's what makes it possible for community also. This institution is, I think, the center of the Slippery Rock area. I mean, this is it.
Mm-hmm.
If it went down,
mm-hmm,
all these jobs went away, all this money coming in,
you're right, but
millions and millions of dollars. So there has to always be a balance between what the individual needs to have a good life and what the institution can afford and still remain viable. Because once the institution stops being viable, the individuals get nothing.
Right. I think there's an impression, though, of union leadership as being, just give us everything we want, and not cognizant of the other side. So that's good to hear.
We were.
Yeah, of course.
I was
You'd have to be.
And the other, and most of the other union, local union presidents were also. State ABSCOF presidents tend to be less so. But they're looking at an organization that's the state ABSCOF organization, not the campus.
Right.
So.
Right.
What they want, right?
Right. They're not in touch. They're not working with the presidents.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So it's all about how they can get the most from their members.
Right.
Where I think the local presidents are, yes, taking care of the members, but also taking care of the members means maintaining the viability of the institution they're working. Yeah.
Right. Right.
Yeah. So it is. It's a real. So, yes, I did think about that long before I became provost. In fact, one of the reasons I believe that Bob Smith asked me to do that when Warren found other ways to entertain himself was that I had spent, when he came, I was the union president, and I spent a lot of time explaining to him how the unions worked, why they worked, and why it wasn't harmful. Because he was really nervous about unions when he came. I mean, he hadn't worked in that environment. Mm-hmm. He had brought in kind of, I think, a naive view of it's us and them. that the unions were harmful rather than helpful.
Right, that stereotype.
Yeah, and I said to him one day, I said, no union, and you're going to individually negotiate with each one of 400 faculty members about what their salaries and benefits are?
That's all you'll ever do.
That's it. That's your job then. Yeah, you got other, if you want other things to happen, maybe you should figure out a way to organize that. Oh, we already have, never mind. And the beauty of ABSCOF is, I said, we will negotiate a contract that's not unreasonable, and it won't be on you. Mm-hmm. It'll be in Harrisburg.
Right.
The local people don't have to get beat up on that.
Mm-hmm.
So he came to appreciate, he never was as comfortable with unions as a lot of people that have grown up in that environment. Mm-hmm. But he came to understand the value, too.
But the threat of a strike every 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, oh, God, that
sure
made him nervous.
Yeah.
I kept referring. I said, it's a dance. It's a dance. They're going to take this step, and then we're going to take this step. I said, as long as nobody steps on others' toes, it's going to be okay, you know, at the end of the day. But I said, don't step on toes. It won't help you.
And he doesn't need to.
No, there's no reason to.
Yeah.
No, and I know.
Keep your head down.
Yep, let it go by. Yeah, it's not going to hurt anybody. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You don't have to go out and, you know, shoot the strikers or, you know, the demonstrators. It just happens. Let it be. Hmm. And it doesn't, you know, no one wanted a strike. No one ever does. You know, it's always, because of the nature of negotiations, it has to be a real possibility or else it can't function.
Mm-hmm.
If it isn't a real possibility, then there's unionism's dead.
Yeah.
Because that's all they have
right.
to say. They can withhold their services if they're not adequately compensated.
Yeah, that's the side of the bargain.
That's the only bullet in the gun.
So when you were ABSCOF president, you went through probably at least three
several contracts.
Did any of them get really sticky, or did you always have fun?
The one that was kind of the most fun, I think, was Bill Fulmer was the state president,
mm-hmm.
and we had gone on for quite a while on that one. And the Board of Governors was meeting at East Strasburg's campus, and so we were close, but we weren't getting there, you know. This was one where the system office is going to, this was when they hired an outside negotiator, and they went and got the contract, which didn't work. They thought sure they could, you know. It's like, but so the state ABSCOF got together with the East Strasburg people, and so when the Board of Governors showed up on campus, faculty members had wheelbarrows with all their office stuff, and they ripped wheelbarrows out. It's kind of a funny. It was drama, right?
Uh-huh.
It was drama, but it worked.
Part of the dance.
It did. The dance happened, and McCormick said, "We're going to settle this," and they did.
So yeah, seeing it acted out, I guess.
Yeah, and that's but what happened in that negotiation. Was when we went, prior to that, there were 5 steps from the original, there were five service steps. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That was it, 5% raise on each one, right? But then they started adding them. So they'd added some. And what happened was the speed from which a faculty member went from new to top of the scale was out of sync with the national model.
Mm-hmm.
And so what the system decided was they had to fix that. And they did. We ended up with the first 5 steps are 5% now, but then after that they're 2.5% raises.
So they did add on
they
to that.
Added, they
didn't just stretch that out.
They stretched it out, and they
add
a little bit at the top,
huh.
Right? Which is how they get a buy-in, right? You get a little more money, but you're going to wait significantly longer before you get there.
Yeah.
But they'd been trying to do that for quite a while. They had a G step at one time, and then to get to G1, or I think it was called you had to be a G for 3 or 4 years. Mm-hmm. So they were stretching the top one out. Then they called that a Z step because they're trying.
Yeah, they know more.
Exactly. So they figured out that numbers were infinite, but if you got to Z, you were done. Yeah. So it was an interesting. But each one of the contracts are interesting negotiations because it's always a different group of people, a different dynamic, a different point in time in the economy of the state mm-hmm. and the nation. So they're all kind of strange mixes. I mean, this last one was, by the time they signed that, we signed that in July, it'll almost be 3 years
yeah.
of constant
yeah.
negotiation.
It's time to start the next one.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it is. So.
And when they started back in the 70s, didn't they start pretty strong, even though the national economy wasn't very good in the 70s?
The contract, the early contract was developed around a public school teacher's contract. Hmm. So the union parts of it were very good. The salaries weren't.
They weren't?
No. Hmm. When McCormick, he was the first chancellor, took over, one of the things he said we need to do is to start creating a stronger system, stronger institutions, by paying better and requiring better credentials.
Hmm.
So, and that's sort of where that happened. And that at that time, the contracts were internally negotiated. So, in the system office. Mm-hmm. So Apscoff had always had, they pre-existed the system.
Mm-hmm.
So they had had the legal people help them, or the Apscoff president, state president, would negotiate. So, and they negotiated against the HR person at the state system, who at least for quite a few years was Ed Kelly.
Mm-hmm.
And what they, and for what, and that's, when they were doing that, they were actually trying to build better salaries for faculty. The system understood the need for that. McCormick mm-hmm. did. But the other thing were the benefit packages were good, and it was the earlier referenced negotiation where they brought, the system brought in Whiteside was his name, I can't remember his first name now, to straighten things out, because the Board of Governors had figured out that by having that negotiations work that way, everyone at the negotiations table would have the same benefit package at the end of it. So there wasn't a lot of motivation to be too hardball to that too much there, yeah? So they'd pretend, but nothing, yeah. So that's that bringing in that external body was how they got around in some ways. And you know, they were right. I mean, in some ways there was no way to move anything anywhere in that mod. So they brought in the external negotiator who started, and they've done that ever since. I mean, we know, depends who the governor is, but whether the external negotiator is a Democrat or a Republican, but they're all legal that's connected with the governor's office somehow.
Was this the first time that Apscoff brought in an external negotiator?
They hired Cobb, I think, was their first one, yeah. As far as I can remember.
So before this time, before Davidson?
Yeah. Cobb did it for years and years.
Mm-hmm.
He made his career out of representing Apscoff in some ways. And, I kind of like Cobb. He's kind of an interesting guy. I've known him for 20, 25 years. That's mm-hmm. a long time to know somebody in that position and not have some kind of relationship with them, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it was good. What other excitement did we
have? Well, let's come back to Slippery Rock, and maybe when you were a new kid on the block or whatever, who were the movers and shakers? Let's go back to this. On campus. So who, in 81, Who was the union president?
I think it was McCoskey.
So Wilma had already been?
Yeah.
She did her little stint?
Yeah. And Wilma's been was a significant player.
Yeah, she stuck with it.
For a long time. Yeah. She still has a role on campus mm-hmm. that's significant. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, yes. So that, in terms of the union, Bob was important. Steve Gagliardo was there. William Taylor, Bill Taylor was around. Kate was here, but not so much in the union earlier. She kind of jumped into that a little later.
Hmm.
She was, I think, in some ways, when I could get, and I was Kate's vice president.
Huh.
Okay? So from 92 to 94, I was vice president of the union. She thought, because she didn't have a terminal degree, she couldn't get promoted. But I think she thought if she did enough service, they would make an exception,
mm-hmm.
and they didn't.
So
then she said to me one day, she said, I don't want to do this again. So she said, would you do it? And I said, I guess so. So then I became the union president for the next 9 years. It's just strange, if you look, up until when I did this, there weren't a lot of long-term
mm-hmm.
union presidents,
yeah.
which, I don't know why. This allowed me to create an executive committee that was more responsive to the campus needs. When I started, it was Steve was on it, and Bill Taylor was on it, and Bill Barnett, who was in communication, he's retired now. And some other old-timers who had pretty much were entrenched in a militant us uh-huh. versus them attitude, uh-huh. which, I mean, okay, but it didn't do any good.
Right.
You can be that way if you want, but it's not helping anything. So by being the president for as long as I was, I had the opportunity to reform some of that committee, so it was more it was still very strong in terms of union rights, but it was more understanding of the relationship between what we had to have between union and management in order to have a strong functioning institution.
So that was Jace Kondravy, right, was your VP?
Yep, Jace was my VP the whole time I was president. Wilma was on the committee
at large. She's
yeah always been there.
Okay.
Sharon Sikora was mm-hmm. She was the grievance chair then. She replaced her for Core.
Oh, huh.
He did that up until she did it.
Huh.
And so that was a big part of who that was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, that persisted then because Wilma's still on and
yeah.
Sharon's still on and Jace just stepped down last
yeah.
year. So
yeah, they were good people.
Yeah.
And,
so, Deb Cohen, I don't know if she's on now.
Yeah, I don't know either. She wasn't on now.
She wasn't, okay.
She's a newer person.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Relatively speaking.
Yeah, right, exactly. You know how that works once you've been here long enough.
Yeah, I do actually. It starts to get a little scary. So the other old-timers, when you came on, I was thinking of Hunter.
Hunter was here, yep. Hunter was here. He was
in your department, too.
Yes, Hunter was definitely a colorful character.
Mm-hmm,
I actually helped Hunter retire.
You encouraged him to retire?
Oh, yes. His wife didn't want him to retire because she wanted him at home.
Wait, let's cut that out.
And I mean, he was in his 70s and he was tired.
Mm-hmm.
He was worn out.
Yeah, I remember seeing the commencement and just.
He was worn out. And I said, you know, he wasn't getting the job done, so. Mm-hmm. We had a long talk, and he decided he would retire. So, but it was, I liked Hunter. He was a smart guy. He drifted a bit far, you know, from the center. So he was an interesting dude. Bob McElvain was in the department.
I know that name. Mm-hmm.
Mike Kelly
mm-hmm.
and Penny Kelly. Egan's were characters.
Egan?
So, Egan.
Hmm.
Joe and Joan Egan, they were. He had been a boxer in college, and he was a big guy. We'd get mad, you could see his veins pulsing and stuff. He was a scary guy. People were afraid of him. He was pretty harmless, so he would, you know, he just, oh. I didn't care. So that, when I redid the master's program in English, he taught Victorian Lit. And the graduate level, Victorian Lit, all the graduate courses were taught at night. And he wouldn't teach at night. So I took the Victorian Lit course out because it never got taught, because he would insist he was the only one that could teach it, and then he would teach at night. So the meeting, the department meeting where I explained these curricular changes, he went ballistic. He was screaming, how dare you have a program without Victorian Lit in it? My face said, Joe, do you teach Victorian Lit? Yes. Will you teach at night? No. I said, what? What are we arguing about?
Yeah.
If it's in there and it doesn't get taught, is it any different than not being in there?
And
let's
it should
think through this for a minute.
Yeah, exactly.
We don't offer it. And what my point was that we should have a program that every 2 years, everything in it got taught.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
If
not, what are we doing? We can have special topics course where if you want to teach something every once in a while in an area that probably doesn't warrant regular teaching, we can do that. But why have 20 courses that never get taught sitting there just in case?
If prospective students look at that, they think they're going to get to take Victorian literature.
Right. Yeah, and they could. Right. And they were probably happy after the fact, whether they knew it or not. So he was one of the characters in the department. There were a lot of, English was very good at characters. Very good at characters. And Jerry O'Malley was in the English department. He's still alive. He's 88 maybe now. I see Jerry once in a while. Hassel Sled.
I knew Hassel.
Hassel was a better person off campus than in the department. Yeah, he was a problem at times. Okay. But anyway, I had a very turbulent several years in the English department. But of course, when I got there, they were so dysfunctional in some ways. They didn't want to do anything. And without my knowing it at the time, it took me a while to figure out all the rules. When I started as a tenure track faculty in the fall of 82, they made me in charge of the evaluation committee, which you can't do that to your tenure.
Right.
You play contract, but they didn't care. In fact, the third year I was doing it, I figured it out, and I pointed that out to them in the department meeting that I really wasn't eligible to be on the committee, much less chair it, because you couldn't be on your own evaluation committee.
There was only one
evaluation committee, and I was being evaluated all the time.
Yeah.
And they said, oh, okay. Then Steve Curry says, well, I recommend that we vote to violate that part of the contract.
Oh,
and
no.
They voted to do it. And so I was still the chair of the committee.
Yikes.
And I didn't care. I mean, I didn't mind doing it. It was just, I didn't want to be in violation of the contract.
Well, that plus puts you in a bad position because everybody hates you, and then they're evaluating you.
Yeah, I learned how to figure that problem out, too.
Mm.
You know? So when they complained about somebody, I had that person be the, well, you go observe them this year, and then we can say how bad they are. And no one ever would, you know. They always would just say, oh, yeah, she's wonderful, he's wonderful, so. That was kind of a strange world, too.
Hmm.
So we did that. I was on the hiring committee every year until 1 year they voted me off.
Why?
Because I had a vision for what should happen, and I knew how to make it work on a hiring process to get people that would match
perform.
That. Yeah, match that vision better. And they figured out that I was controlling it, and they decided they didn't like it. So they voted me off the committee that year. Then they didn't like how that worked, so they quit doing that, too. I was allowed back on again. But then I became chair, which then I didn't get on the hiring committee after that. I had a separate role in the process. And it was an interesting time. Jace was only a part-time in the department initially. She started in academic support services, so and until she got promoted to full professor, which was the same year I did, which must have been around, I don't know, 95 maybe. So then she transferred over. But she figured she had a, because she did all of her work in academic support, her scholarly work, rather than English, she figured she would have had a difficulty demonstrating that she had what was appropriate in English to be promoted to full. So she stayed in academic support until that got done, and then she transferred over. And she was fine. She was good in English. She had good credentials and was fine. So, but it was just how she worked it out at the time. And cranked up one of her friends on campus who never liked that idea so well. We'll not mention
him. We need not go there.
No.
What about, who were the administrators as you were coming up?
When I started here, Herb Reinhart was the president, which we refer to as Herb period.
Yes, I heard that.
Yeah, it was kind of funny. But he didn't have much impact at the faculty level. He apparently, other managers didn't find him very much fun. But he didn't bother faculty, so faculty didn't care.
So who was provost? Faust?
No.
No.
Ebersold.
Oh, he's provost first, huh?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Actually, I think Ebersold was the first provost who was at Slippery Rock. Before that, they had vice presidents for academic affairs, but no provost. And it wasn't until, I think, the systems, the Slippery Rock and the other schools became a system in 1983 they had the provost position.
So what's the difference? Because it's now it's a slash.
Yeah. That's provost, vice president for academic affairs. The provost is the on-campus leader if the president's off-campus. And theoretically, at least, the provost is not then just in charge of academic affairs, because if the president's off-campus, the other VPs fall beneath that.
Okay.
So that clarified that in a way for everyone. So, Ebersold was the first, and then Faust, Griffiths, then Smith, and me.
Just a handful.
And so far, I'm the only one to, I claim I'm the only provost emeritus that's ever had, they've ever had at Slippery Rock. I'm actually the only provost that ever retired as a provost at Slippery Rock.
Yeah, right.
All the others had other options.
Huh. What did Ann do?
She was only interim.
Oh.
So she was never, she did that for a year while they did the search. So, and then she retired as a dean.
Hmm. Okay.
So that was an amusement, huh?
All right. Any other people you want to talk about who are significant in your time here?
It's an interesting group. You know, people that you don't always on campus in faculty positions. There are people you know and don't know, and you see and don't see.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the people who I learned when I became unknown the whole time I was here, is kind of understood what he did in some ways, did not have total respect for until I became provost and really saw what he did, is Bob Watson.
Hmm.
And Bob is just did amazing work for this institution.
Yeah.
In student life, but you know, it really was significant. And I think the difficulty someone had following him might not have been as obvious had he not been here,
mm-hmm. you know,
because he really did do an amazing job at that. So, and when he was doing that, and I was new in the provost position, he was very helpful in getting me to look at a bigger picture of how academic affairs and student life could work together as a unit, and recalibrate a little bit my academic bias, which I tend to prefer faculty. You know, I just do.
But it's true. We don't know what they
what they do
I know. Over there.
Exactly. And, yeah. And that's sort of invisible.
Mm-hmm.
So he was very helpful in helping me see that, and and giving me and bringing me into that role in a different way than I probably would have gone had he not been there.
Huh.
So he was very helpful in that regard. Hardworking, smart guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I know more from the history side, and that was his real role, was how you know him in student life.
Yep. Yeah. So, and before that, he did. He was in charge of academic services for years, too.
Huh.
And they all reported to him, including Amanda, who, you know, she, he shaped Amanda in many, many ways,
huh.
you know, if that's possible. She's not easily shaped, but she used to be easier.
I'm going to have to cut that out, too, probably. Okay.
Yeah.
well, you mentioned when we became a state system. I don't know if I'd put that together. That's when we became a university, too.
Yes.
That was that same year.
Yeah.
So that's why
we
became a university?
Yeah.
Okay.
We all became. Yeah. It's, as the good guy I knew, Pat Hartwell at IUP, at that time they were the only university in the system.
Right,
used to tell, yesterday you guys couldn't even spell university, now you, now you are one.
Ouch. Yeah. But did everybody take on graduate programs at that time? That you?
No, we had a graduate programs before that. It had nothing to do with that.
Okay.
It's universities are organizational structures compared with colleges. And so a university's a collection of colleges.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
So up until then, at least we were all colleges, so we didn't identify.
Really, within Slippery Rock State College, they weren't the colleges.
We had at the time when I started, there was they were arts and science, natural, and then in arts and science there was natural science and math. Humanities and fine arts, you know, behavioral sciences.
Mm-hmm.
So they had all the pieces there, but they didn't organize it in the same way they did once we became a university, although it was very invisible in some ways. It was just when that's when they made the provost overseeing all that. But the change was structural on paper more than in reality. I mean, the next day you didn't know the difference.
Again,
I mean, I was
that,
here in 81, 82, 83. I couldn't tell. You know, it just all looked the same to me.
They changed the signs at the road.
Yeah, and we didn't. Yeah, exactly. They changed the name on the stationery. And it wasn't until Bob Smith came that they kind of reshuffled the colleges.
Mm-hmm.
Created new colleges that had different names and stuff, but that wasn't because we were a university. That change had already remained. You know, it was just a structural change and a name change. It's interesting, though. So,
but we didn't call ourselves of Pennsylvania at that point yet, did we? Even though
we were
part of the state system.
We were Slippery Rock College.
Right, but when we became a university,
we became
Slippery Rock University.
Slippery Rock State University,
But when did that of Pennsylvania get added on? It's fairly recent,
it
seems to me.
Yeah, somewhere in there, but no one has ever liked the system has never liked what their name is. Because you can't be Penn State, right? Penn State's been taken. Mm-hmm. So, unlike Ohio State, which also has OSU and Ohio State, right? Mm-hmm. We have Penn State and the University of Pennsylvania, neither one of which are state-owned schools, right?
Right, right.
So, which is kind of a strange system. But so it was, no one likes the Sheehy, the state system of higher ed. They didn't like that because they always thought it didn't look right. So then they decided to go to the Pennsylvania state system of higher ed. They got the name Pennsylvania in that way.
Just, that makes sense.
Yeah, exactly. And that's when they decided they'd add the...
When it became Pennsylvania.
They, if Harrisburg had its, Harrisburg Central had its way, we would be Pennsylvania System School at Slippery Rock.
No.
Well, it's that, you know.
That's catchy.
That makes sense, though. Yeah, that's how easy those things slip in.
Yeah.
That was kind of, that's the trunk and limb model, right? Mm-hmm. Like Penn State has that, mm-hmm. right?
They have this Penn State
and at Clarion or wherever.
Yeah. But we didn't evolve that way.
No, exactly. Yeah. We started out as totally separate institutions and created a central office to cover some of the issues that are more readily done there. Negotiating contracts.
Yeah. Do you think that was a good thing and we'll always have that centralized
model? I think it'll probably be there. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Things can change. I mean, there's a lot of political jostling in higher ed right now. So. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to guess how it's going to all fall out. It probably never all falls out. It just kind of... Higher ed institutions are very resilient and resistant to change. You can make change on paper, and the next day you can't tell it ever happened, or the next month, or the next year, or the next decade.
Everybody just ignores it.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, if they don't like it, they don't do it.
Do you think we'll keep all of our 14 campuses?
I can't see politically how they're going to not do that. Hmm. I mean, that's a political choice. It's not a business choice. It's not a rational choice. It's political. It's, if you were going to close this down, what would you be saying? The university's gone and
community? Right, yeah, you don't merge two towns, like right, Lock exactly. Haven and Mansfield.
Right, exactly. There's how far apart, and why would you bother? I mean, there would be ways to consolidate some of the back office work, probably, that would reduce some of the costs, but that would be invisible anyway. No one was really part of generating the educational mission of the institution would even notice it happened.
They tried to do that with libraries, with the Keystone Library Network, which you were involved with.
Yeah, for 6 years I was on that insanity, listening to people talk in acronyms.
That's our stock and trade.
Yes, it is. You guys are good at it. Do what I guess. How many acronyms are there? Oh. More than you can ever remember.
But was your sense that that was a useful move?
I think
cost saving.
TLN was useful for the digital component of the library. Yeah. Other than that, no. Mm-hmm. You know, you need people in libraries helping people coming into libraries, and I was never willing to say books weren't fun. I love books. I love to look at them.
You like to water in the stacks. Yeah,
exactly. I think that's where it's happening. Yeah. For me, research, in some ways, when I was working on my dissertation, I'd go get a book and I'd be poking around its neighborhood and find things I hadn't found existed yet were suddenly just sitting there. Yeah. So there's a serendipity that gets involved in that you don't get if you're refining a search online.
Right, or even in a card catalog. Yeah. I mean, that didn't suddenly make that work a whole lot better necessarily. Yeah. You still need to go into the stacks
to see what's happening.
See the neighborhood,
see what the neighborhood's like. Yeah. Yeah. Who are they living next to?
Well, yeah, because not everything gets cataloged exactly correctly to make it collocate. Well, I was glad you were on that, because it seemed like it really helped you understand what we did.
Yeah,
hopefully,
yeah.
In a good way.
I think the library is in some ways the critical center of the university. I mean, it's, no matter how you define it, I still have books in my library. Mm-hmm. So, and that requires a building, the kind of space you need to give to them and stuff like that. But it's also, I'm very comfortable with the concept of the library as a learning center too. Mm-hmm. They're both, they're not just one or the other. It's, right. It's not just book storage or digital retrieval.
Right.
It's also a place where people go and come together and learn, and either with the materials or with other people. And
hopefully interacting with us.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So, definitionally, almost historically, the library's been the heart of the institution. That's why they used to rate institutions on how many books they had.
Yeah.
It mattered.
We still report on that.
I know, you still report on it. Probably not institutionally as important as it used to be, mm-hmm. but it was a significant part of accreditation.
Well, when we do the accreditation, we also have to say, we'll help our different departments, is what schools were sharing things with, what consortial mm-hmm. groups were part of, to borrow, mm-hmm. for shared borrowing.
Yeah, because everyone has to have access to the core knowledge that we have as a society, or else there's an educational gap.
And I agree, it does need to be at your fingertips. It does need to be in the building on campus that you can walk in and grab it.
Yeah.
So not maybe there's something at Bloomsburg I could use while I'm not at Bloomsburg.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And by the time I get it here, it's not working.
Right, I needed it yesterday.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's see if we can wrap this up.
You've had enough of me.
No, but I think we've answered most of the questions. If you have other campus activities you want to talk about, other committees that you were involved in when you, maybe before you became...
I was on every academic committee except promotion.
Huh.
At some time or another.
Wow.
That was the only one I avoided. I was doing other things. I was on the university curriculum committee from 1992. Until 2003.
Huh.
So the whole time when I did it for Kate, she was president of the union. I went because she didn't want to, and then I did it for myself when I was president.
Did you think that was important as union president, or I mean,
I
have to represent it at least? But
yeah, I was when I got promoted to, the year I got promoted to full professor. I was the head of the English Department Curriculum Committee, the chair of the Humanities and Fine Arts Curriculum Committee, on the Liberal Studies Curriculum Committee, and on the University-wide Curriculum Committee. I always thought that curriculum, library and curriculum, that's how you end up with the university.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? And I always thought curriculum was an incredibly important part of what defined the institution.
And if you know what's going on there, you know what's going on.
Yep. Yeah. You can see how it works. You can see why we're doing it. You can modify it, work with it. When I know people didn't like, particularly the dropping of one of the required English courses, mm-hmm. not everyone was equally thrilled by that.
Yes.
Although I would point out that 2/3 of the votes were in favor and 1/3 opposed. So in terms of the referendum on it, it was a campus-wide thing. And it was only because of my ceaseless meddling in curriculum that happened. But it was also a way to balance out how I viewed what I think is going to ultimately become the model for institutions, where curriculum isn't based on tradition but based on meeting competencies. And that's not easy to do because faculty aren't used to thinking of it that way. Mm-hmm. And I saw this opportunity as a way to try to start getting everyone to think, not just English, mm-hmm. who don't think about things anyway, from my past experience. But to get the rest of the campus departments to think about, well, here's something we want our students to be able to do. That's a competence we want them to have. Mm-hmm. How are we going to get them to have that now? Right? So it, I tried to get them to, the point was to try to get that to be a competence initiator. Because mostly people don't think about curriculum in terms of, here's a competence, how we meet it, and then design something to meet it.
Yeah.
And I know for years as chair of English, and when we had the research writing component, people complained that they, oh, you guys taught them this and they don't know anything. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, they don't know anything about what you want in
biology. Your discipline.
Right, so.
Right. And theoretically, College Writing 1 should teach them the basics, right? And then they get the
subject matter itself should decide what they want those students to have in terms of research, because there is really no generic research.
Right. But how do they teach that with what they're already teaching and not add additional credit hours?
Well,
seems like that's the trick.
But see, by reducing the required liberal studies credits
by
three, you then have an opportunity to add it, to get the you can get your competency by adding three more credit hours anywhere you want. So it wasn't adding credit hours, it was shifting it from a generic definition of what research was, which was being covered by one department, to having each department have the opportunity, in fact, the requirement. It's an opportunity they can't resist, right?
Yeah.
to define what they want and how they want it met.
But not to have to add the three credit hours within their major requirement?
They could if they wanted
to.
Could afford to, yeah, if they weren't already bumped up against the limit.
Right.
And if they were, they could figure out other ways of managing that. There are ways around things like limits.
But people would like to hear those ideas from you. But
I tried to tell people these things a lot. Everyone that would listen, I told this to, okay? But they hear what they want to hear.
Mm-hmm.
And it's academes so wonderfully resistant to change, because if they don't have to, they don't. Right? Oh, yeah, blah, blah, blah. What did he just say? Oh, never mind, it won't matter, right?
I don't want to have to change my course.
Or they don't think about it until it's necessary. But it was actually, I thought, beneficial to their departments to take control of something that they believed was important,
mm-hmm.
define it, and help their students be better at it.
I see the sense of that.
Yeah. So some of the things that people griped about the most that I did, I thought made more sense than things I did that they never said anything about at all. It's okay, right?
What were some of those?
Yeah, I'm not going to tell you about that. Yeah. So, but we did fine in terms of the 10 years that I was in that position, the institution did well. I'm not taking credit for it, mm-hmm. but it did happen.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know people have worked real hard in times when there's demographic downturns and stuff like that. It doesn't matter how good they are, they can't make students appear who weren't born. The unborn aren't very good students.
But you got to broaden out and non-traditionals and all that.
There's ways of doing that. This area has not been ever very good at bringing non-traditionals to campus.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the other part of that then is, well, online. But online is a bizarre world. And we don't do bad in terms of things like special ed, where we have a well-recognized special ed department.
Mm-hmm.
For a long time, but when I first started as provost, it was obvious to me that Harrisburg was going to change the world, and you couldn't major in special ed as a standalone major.
Really?
Yeah, and you can't. But that, so when I understood that was going to take place, I talked to the people in special ed and I said, "What are you going to do? What are you going to do?" And we talked about it, and that's when we talked about getting their master's degree online as a way of compensating for the student issues they would have if they were no longer a standalone major. And they did. And it was, I think, very successful. Is very successful in terms of generating revenue. I don't want to speculate on anything beyond that. But it's very hard to speculate beyond that, even if it's in person, right? You know, they either have students in classes or they don't, right?
Yep.
And that's about all you can tell. But I never saw that. I saw that as a way of helping the department sustain itself. I didn't see it as a way of replacing what I see as the critical face-to-face experience that undergraduate students need. In non-traditional students, my sense is they tend to be very few of them living out on the farms around here.
Mm-hmm.
And the ones that are trying to enhance their education tend not to want to come live on a campus. It's expensive. They have jobs, they have families. There's the local community college, there's Youngstown University right next door to them. You know, they live in the city, Pittsburgh, there are plenty of, you know, there's that needs being met at other institutions besides Slippery Rock. And for most students, it's a hard commute. I mean, if they're up in the Sharon area, they can go to Penn State, they can go to Butler County Community College up there somehow. I'm never sure how that worked. As near as I can tell, that wasn't in Butler County anymore, but Butler County Community College has expanded beyond its borders. Yes, it has. And so there's lots of ways that those non-traditional students get met in a place they already exist without having to come here and live or without having to commute an hour or so to get here. So I had never seen us as having a real good shot at making up loss in undergraduate students with non-traditional undergraduate students.
Coming to campus.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But we can make up the enrollments in some ways with online experiences at the graduate level.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's been fairly helpful.
In undergraduate.
And undergraduate. We don't have a lot of undergraduate online, but we have some. I mean, we have our RN to BSN. But that's, in fact, not so much different from a graduate program in some ways.
Right, so
because
the RN
students are locked into here, and then the RN students are locked into a job. And then because it's online, they can do our BSN without living here
mm-hmm.
or even coming here. So, which helps the nursing people create, and that's what they do. Now they're getting the MSN online. They want to do the master's because they believe their BSN students then would like to get a master's.
Mm-hmm.
And once you've got the Slippery Rock brand, then it's easier to continue it. And we got that approved, but whether or not that'll be vibrant enough to survive, I don't know. So this is a 5-year trial. You know, if you can't get the enrollments in 5 years to sustain it, don't keep it.
But won't they have to hire more teaching faculty to support it?
And those will be a problem, yeah. But nursing turns over fast. Faculty, because we tend to get terminally degree qualified nursing faculty who have burned out of the profession and have, you know, 5 or 10 years left of their careers,
uh-huh.
and then they retire.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not a big problem. So anyway, I don't know where Slippery Rock's going to be in a few years, because it's hard to look at the demographics we're bouncing through and seeing. I tried to get in motion before I left some degrees that would try to help compensate, like an MBA,
right.
A physician's assistant,
right.
a Master of Science in Nursing, you know, because one of the other things I did was get rid of master's degrees that weren't functioning.
Like English?
People didn't necessarily like that so well either.
Okay.
Yeah, like exercise science.
Mm-hmm.
Does anybody ever mention they used to have a master's degree? So one of the first meetings I had with them was the provost down there, and they said they needed more staff because they couldn't meet all their needs. And when I looked what they were doing, they were putting staff into a graduate program that had 10, 11, 8 students in a class, and they were bursting at the seams at the undergraduate, and they wanted staff. Uh-huh. I said, why not put your master's on moratorium, meet this need, see how it works, try to make your undergraduate degree as strong as possible, and if you still want to do that master's degree once we get this problem under control, we'll look at it again. We're not throwing it out, but we'll look at, you know. And, you know, in 3 years, they were so engaged in creating the undergraduate program, they didn't want to do it. Because the master's wasn't helping them. It was just distracting them. So it's, English has had a master's degree for a long time. But it never had an identity. It was never clear whether these were master's degree students were going on to get PhDs. Local school teachers were just trying to get the added credentials so they could make more money, right? Or somebody who got a bachelor's degree in English and didn't know what to do.
Right.
So there were three. But it was never structured out and say, okay, here's what we're going to do, here's why we're going to do it, and here's where these kids are going. This is what it's for.
The clear mission, right?
Right. There was no mission. It was just, and no one would do it. I kept saying to him, you got to do this. Or, you know, I'm not going to let this continue. Because they always had just enough, 8, 10, 12 students. But if you're putting a resource in there and then making it up by having large undergraduate classes, why are you doing that? Why not get rid of this and put the take the resource and reduce your big class sizes at the undergraduate level, so, and get the students that are really paying for this the benefit of it. So they
Same
didn't like
history.
That so well. Yeah, history pretty much is. I always thought history and English could create a master's degree, right? I think it would be brilliant. It would be a wonderful experience for the students. They could study the two in conjunction. They could look at Renaissance history and Shakespeare together, you know?
Yeah.
But history and English don't like one another so well. Well, Jack and Allison maybe, but they're both retired now. No, it's always been a strange relationship. History tends to be more male-focused, and English more female-focused. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a strange.
Could be a good mix, though. You can go back to that married model.
Yeah, exactly. Back to that marriage model, yeah, exactly. Oh, well, so there we are.
All right. Well, I don't know how our tape is doing. I hope it's still running. Do you want to jump down? Well, what do you miss, if anything, about being here? You haven't gone that long, so.
I don't. I was done before I left, okay? I was tired. I didn't want to do this anymore. It was a wonderful job, a wonderful experience. I really enjoyed my 30-plus years at Slippery Rock. I had done what I could do.
Yeah.
I had seen it. I had changed it. I had modified it where I could. And I was done. I didn't have any brilliant solutions to any problems, and I didn't have any more interest in the kind of stress that comes with getting sued and defending the institution, hearing people whine and carry on. You know, just it overwhelms you after a while. People don't line up and tell you how good it is.
Yeah.
You know, they don't. And that's okay. And I understood that when I started it, and I understand it now, but I don't miss it. I like Bob Smith. I'm going to go visit him sometime in August in Tennessee. And I enjoyed working with him, and he quit, and we hired Cheryl. I love Cheryl. She's a great person. I would have liked to have spent 10 years working with Cheryl, but they were 10 I'd already spent, so I couldn't re-spend them. So.
Yeah.
And I said, even before we hired her, I said, I'm retiring as soon as we get a president here. I have a little orientation time with that person so they get at least some sense of what we're doing. And I'm retiring. I did, and She wanted me to stay longer, and I wanted to leave earlier, and
yeah.
we got a date, and I went out, and I have not missed it. I'm busy, I enjoy what I do. I was up this morning, I ran 5 miles on the treadmill.
I'm glad you're doing that.
Yeah. I'm working on a garage project. I painted the garage, now I'm building shelving in, so I've got to get those done today, right? So I can get my car back in the garage. Things are important out there right now. So I don't miss the institutional problems. And they're always there.
I was glad that you stayed on, maybe even longer than you wanted to, but for the transition, that was important for the institution.
I thought so, too. So I just did. So I didn't see that she would have liked me to stay longer. I didn't see that that would help. I figured we got to where we got, and she saw how it worked, and it wasn't going to change. That was it. And the institution needs to get used to a different leadership team,
mm-hmm.
and that's easier done without me popping around every so often and offering helpful hints to new provosts and things. It just doesn't need that. And other people don't need to think that they can call me and I'm their seat. So I said, you know, when I retired, I'm going to spend a year not engaged in anything here.
Mm-hmm.
So we have months to go yet before I get that year completed. But I don't miss it. I do not miss it.
People get called back, you know.
I saw that. That was scary. That was scary.
Yeah.
I called Diana back. Yes.
You did that.
I did that, yeah.
Cruel.
Yeah, and I got Kathleen convinced to be a dean for a while.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. She never minded that.
Yeah. Yeah.
She was good at that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she was good at it, yeah. So I'm not looking at that as an option particularly. Yeah, I'm 68 now. How old do you want to work?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I figured.
67 and a half, I think, is the
that's about it for me.
Now,
yeah. I made that, didn't I?
Yeah,
just
did.
Barely. I'm a little over 67 and a half, but not much over, yeah. It's good.
Good. I'm glad you're happy in your retired life.
Yep, doing fine.